not going to see me again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And then as the disciples point out the beautiful buildings of the temple, Jesus starts Matthew 24 with that stunning prophecy that these are all impressive, but not one of them is going to be left standing on another. That what you see, as beautiful and majestic and grand as it is not going to last. It is all going to come down. We saw that what he is saying there is not just that the temple system is going to come down, not just that some idea that the priesthood is going to lose its power, although it certainly did, but what literally happened was the temple was actually destroyed. And so we have a historical example of how Jesus prophesies and what that prophetic fulfillment looks like. And that's important as we move through the rest of Matthew 24, because it talks about things yet to come. The disciples ask, well, then when is the end? The first question is when. When is the end? And Jesus' answer essentially is not now. When is the end? The end is not now. And then they ask, what is the sign of your coming in the end of the age? And that is where we started last week, where he says, these are not the signs. It's not just war and rumors of war. It's not just earthquakes and famines. Those are things that are likened to birth pangs, the initial contractions that tell you that something is on the way, but it is not yet. And we know that contractions happen slowly and increasingly and steadily until the birth happens. And so we would anticipate that trials, struggles, troubles, wars, rumors of wars, natural disasters would increase and occur more and more frequently, but that those are not the end, but they do show that an end is coming. In other words, they are not simply a result of living in a fallen world, although they are a result of living in a fallen world. They do show an anticipation of something yet future that will come. But then he started talking about what will specifically mark the time. How will we know? Well, this is how you'll know. And we went through the idea of the abomination of desolation. When that happens, that Daniel talked about, you who read and understand know that the time is near. Then those who are in Judea must flee. Pray that your flight won't be in winter or on a Sabbath, unless those days have been cut short. No one would survive. There's going to be these people that have that are prophets, but they're false prophets, and they deceive and lead many astray, and they're given the power to do these great wonders for a time. So these are all things that are going to mark this particular period of time that Jesus says is a tribulation, a period of tribulation. And today we're going to pick up in verse 29, Matthew 24, 29, and we're going to talk about really the end of those. Because remember, the question is, what is the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? Those are the signs that the coming is near. And now we get to the actual coming of Christ as he preaches it. And he says in verse 29, immediately after the tribulation of those days. We have to stop right there because we have to see that Jesus says that the tribulation is yet future. From the perspective of Jesus, as he ministers at a particular place in history, that tribulation is both definite and future. It is not just the general tribulation that will happen. It is the tribulation associated with those days, a particular marked out period of time that will have a beginning and will have a definite end, because it says after the tribulation of those days. And after the tribulation of those days, something very specific happened, or really some things that are very specific happened. He says, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from the sky and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. He's looking back to the words of Isaiah here, but what does it mean? Because there are many people who take this and they understand that this means that there is going to be something, but that these are more spiritual signs, that these things have either already happened, or that these things continue to happen, or that these things are merely a metaphorical indication of something else happening. But as Jesus pulls these words right out of Isaiah, what should we understand them as? And I think the most helpful thing is to see, well, how has Matthew in particular, and how has Jesus specifically already used prophecy from Isaiah? Because if they've already used it a particular way, then it makes the most sense to see that they would understand it the same way. And as we look back to the birth narrative of Christ, we're told what? That the virgin would conceive and bear a son in Isaiah. And as Mary and Joseph are not married yet, and as the announcement is made to her, she is going to be with child, although she has never known a man. In other words, as the gospel writers look back to that prophecy in Isaiah about a virgin conceiving and bearing a son, they understand that to have a literal fulfillment in Mary's miraculous birth of Jesus Christ. When John the Baptist sends his emissaries to Jesus, John being in prison, and he asks him, and we've been over this, he says, are you the one that we've been looking for, or should we look for someone else? John says, I'm the forerunner of the Messiah, or I thought I was, but I'm in jail and your ministry is pretty small. So are you the right one or not? How does Jesus answer him? He answers him with words taken from Isaiah. He answers him and he says, well, what do you go back and tell John what you see? He says that the blind receive their sight. He says that the lame walk. The dead are raised and the poor have the gospel preached to them. In other words, he looks back at Isaiah's prophecy about what would characterize the comings and dealings of the Messiah, and he says, that is exactly what you see. So go and tell John that exactly what the prophets wrote is what you are seeing. And Jesus did open deaf ears, and he did open blind eyes, and he did make the dead rise spiritually. However, there was a literal component to all of those in his ministry that he was pointing to for John, was there not? And so as Jesus sees Isaiah prophecy, Jesus takes the prophecies of Isaiah relatively literally. In fact, not even relatively, he takes them very literally as he applies them even to himself. And now, as he reaches back and he uses the words of Isaiah again, it makes the most sense to see that there are going to be some spectacular signs in the cosmos, in the created order, that accompany the coming of Christ. After that time of tribulation, there are going to be some unmistakable signs in the sky that are going to mark out the coming of Christ. It makes sense to take them the same way. At the end of a period of unprecedented trouble, there's going to be unprecedented signs in the created order. And remember, Jesus is in the middle of answering the question of what is the sign of your coming and the end of the age. There's going to be tribulation, but after that period, these are the specific signs that accompany my coming and the end of the age. Sun darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from the sky, the powers of heaven will be shaken, and look at verse 30, and then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky. The last sign is that the Son of Man appears in the sky, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming in the sky with power and glory. The last sign, the unmistakable sign, is that the Son comes. His coming is going to be unmistakable. His first entrance into the world was quiet, wasn't it? In fact, unless you were a shepherd on a hillside, or perhaps wise men alerted by a new star, or his mother and father, who were certainly there, his birth would have passed largely without notice on the scale of human history, wouldn't it? He came quietly. Is that a question?
Yeah. Yeah.
It says, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken.
Yes. There's a lot. The question was, when it says the powers of the heavens will be shaken, there's a lot of debate on whether that is physical powers or spiritual powers. That is not a portion of the Isaiah quote. I feel like, or this is my personal understanding, and there's good guys that go back and forth on this. My understanding is that the quote from Isaiah deals with respect to the physical creation being shaken, earth, or moon, sun, stars. And then the departure there speaks of the fear of the spiritual shaking that happens as well. And I think we see that referred to again in Revelation. So it's something we will pick up on in the fall, should the Lord tarry and I ever get around to it. Yes, that is a good question. I see the powers of the heavens there being not only are there going to be physical repercussions here, but spiritual ones as well. And again, that is something that we can deal with as we move through Revelation and the tribulation and the coming again of Christ and all of the fun things that go along with that. Great question. And here we see that his second coming is going to be unmistakable. It is going to be one that comes in power and glory. The Son of Man was going to appear in the sky. And here's what it says. It says, all the tribes of the earth will mourn. Now, there's two ways that this goes, even among people who agree with me eschatologically. One is to see that all the tribes of the earth means all the people of the earth. That is a very interesting way to refer to all the people of the earth as tribes, particularly in the New Testament. And I will tell you where I land on this. Understand that this is me, and this is not a hill for you to die on. The word for earth there is not the typical New Testament word for the sphere or the totality of the earth. It is the word for land. most common used is land. If you read that, all the tribes of the land will mourn, that has a very specific implication. Because this context, we've already said last week, is very, very Jewish, is it not? When you see the abomination of desolation, that means nothing to Gentiles. Because to have the abomination of desolation requires a temple and sacrifice. That is what Daniel was talking about. It is something that interrupts temple service and regular sacrifice. You who are in Judea, flee to the mountains. Pray that your flight not be in winter kind of time or on a Sabbath. Who cares, other than a Jew, if your flight is on a Sabbath? The context of this prophecy, specifically in Matthew, more heavily emphasized in Matthew than in places like Luke, but more heavily emphasized in Matthew is the Jewishness of the nature of this tribulation and the focus of this tribulation, which, by the way, if you look back prophetically, is absolutely one of the two focuses of the coming day of the Lord. Judgment and refining of God's people, the Jews, and then judgment on the nations. We saw that over and over and over. Now, if we read through this, and we read through it as reading, all the tribes of the land will mourn, then tribes of the land, specifically in a Jewish context, points us back to the people of Israel. And if we hear something like, all the people of Israel will mourn, and we've read Zechariah, then that sounds really, really familiar, because in Zechariah chapter 12, he says that when he comes, they will look on him who they have pierced and mourn. It is almost the exact same wording used for the same people. To my understanding, that is the best way to understand that. That this is a relatively specific pronouncement of the response of Jewish people, and I think that makes sense going further too. Yeah, Jason.
So, going back to the sun being darkened, mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And the stars will fall from
heaven. Yep. Is this specific to Israel? No. I think this sign, his second coming, is unmistakable no matter who you are.
Okay.
I think Matthew is pointing the purpose of this specifically at Israel, and we'll kind of pick up why.
Okay.
However, here's the thing, and we talk about some places on earth you see a solar eclipse, some place you don't, right? The lunar eclipse is the same way. It depends on your hemisphere. What happens if the sun goes totally dark? Is there anywhere on earth that would be able to not see that? If the sun goes totally dark, what happens to the moon?
There's no
reflection, because the moon does not produce its own light, does it? Hashtag astronomy class. No. The moon is a giant reflector. It reflects the light of the sun. In other words, if you shut off the sun, you simultaneously shut off the moon, and it does not matter where you are. Those are universal signs. So I would see the sun being darkened as having a universal effect also on the moon. I don't think this is a localized thing that you would have to see. Again, you're going to have guys that disagree. The point of this that is not negotiable from my perspective is that these are unmistakable signs of the sun's coming. That this is not simply another eclipse, lunar or solar. This is not just another meteor shower that we can go out at various times of the year and see at its peak moments. This is something unmistakable that is absolutely unique in human history. Because that is how he's built it up here, that this is a period of tribulation that is unlike anything before or after. This is something absolutely specific. And immediately after that tribulation, not just immediately after trouble, immediately after that tribulation, of those days, this unmistakable stuff happens. And when this stuff happens, the Son of Man is right there. And they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. In other words, when he comes, it is not humble and in a manger this time. It is with power and great glory. Now, how do we take that? How should we understand that? This is a quote from Daniel. How do we use these prophetic passages in the Old Testament? Does it mean that Christ comes in power and glory in the hearts of those that are his, that he establishes his kingdom first here through the lives of his people? Does it mean that that is how the kingdom comes, that when the Son comes in power and glory? Does it take power and glory to illuminate a human heart and cause salvation? Absolutely. But is that what he's talking about? I don't think it is, because if you look forward to Acts chapter 1 and the ascension of Christ, what happens? They're gathered there on the mount, and Jesus is caught up before them. He ascends, and it says he's received by a cloud out of their sight. In other words, Jesus goes up physically in the clouds, right? We remember that? Acts chapter 1, if you're a little rusty, you can read it again. And then there are a couple of angels standing there because the disciples are stuck there like this. They're looking up. They just saw something incredible, but they're stuck there looking up at the cloud where Christ was. He's gone. And the angels say, "What are you doing?" Which the obvious answer is, did you not just see what we just saw? No, but what do the angels say? What are you doing? He is going to come back. How? Same way he went. And it's specific in Acts that there was a cloud involved in his leaving. I think it makes absolute sense to see that the clouds accompany him as he's coming. You put these together, you don't need to seek some other sense of these. It actually all overlaps very, very easily without a lot of gymnastics done to the text. That when the Son of Man is going to come on the clouds of the sky with power and glory, when Daniel wrote that, he meant that the Son of Man would come on the clouds of the sky with power and glory. That this is not some subtle human intrinsic internal heart movement, that this is some physical creation level event that happens when he comes in great power and glory. And then he will send forth his angels with a great trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the sky to the other. Now, the angels are going to come, and they are going to gather his elect. I do not care. I will not put up a fight. most people likely take that verse to understand that when he's talking about gathering the elect from the four winds, that it's those who have come to Christ during this time of tribulation that he is going to gather them together as he institutes his kingdom there. That's fine. That is justifiable from the text. I think it's fine. However, my understanding, this is just Matt, okay? This is a minority opinion, and I get that. You don't have to buy into this. If those that are the tribes of the land are what are in view here, if this is a very, very Jewish context here, and that word for elect there means chosen ones, which echoes strongly back to the Old Testament, the way that I see this is that, again, Christ is pointing this prophecy specifically toward the Jewish people and saying that when he comes on the clouds in power and glory, that he is going to gather Israel from among the nations and bring them back together. And by the way, there is strong, strong prophetic evidence and pretense for that. Isaiah chapter 11, verse 12. He'll lift up a standard for the nations and assemble the banished ones of Israel and will gather the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. Almost exactly the same phrasing. Isaiah 56, 8. The Lord God who gathers the dispersed Israel declares, yet others I will gather to them, though to those already gathered. In other words, those that are already in Israel, I will gather the rest to them. Hosea 1:11, Zechariah 10, Ezekiel 11:17, Ezekiel 20:41, about two dozen other places that talk about the coming of the Messiah is accompanied by a gathering specifically of Israel. Does that mean that those that are Christ's, that are saved through this period of tribulation, don't get brought to him? No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that Jesus is pointing this very, very particularly at his audience at this time. In other words, he is wrapping this whole thing in the prophetic envelope that it is meant to be delivered in. That none of this happens in a vacuum, that all of this is being drawn from and clarified out of the prophets. That when these things happen, then those things are right at the door. And in verse 32, that's exactly what Jesus says. He's essentially going to give them a parable to illustrate the truth that when you see these things, you know something is about to happen. Look at what he says in 32. Learn the parable from the fig tree. When its branches already become tender and it puts forth leaves, you know the summer is near. In other words, when you see a fig tree look like this, you know what time of year it is. You could go into a coma for however long, you wake up, and if you see a fig tree in this state, even if you didn't take a look at a calendar, you could tell generally what time of year it is, yes? And he says, so you too, when you see all of these things, recognize that he is near right at the door. If these particular things are happening, recognize that he is near right at the door. Why do I not think that these are some general, non-specific, spiritual, allegorical signs? Because Jesus doesn't intend them to be that. He says, when you see these things, it ought to give you a particular intellectual understanding of what is happening, and more specifically, what is right about to happen. When you see these things happening, know that he is near, and not only near in the sense of eminent, but he is right at the door. This is the time. Then it brings on that, truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. I grew up in a very, very particular circle where that verse got used a lot. This generation will not pass away. And one of the things that I was taught and that I really always held to when I was growing up was that the idea that the generation that saw Israel regathered, and that was interpreted to mean Israel becoming a nation again, which happened in 1948, that generation wouldn't pass away. And so what happens is you have all kind of, I think, well-intentioned but misinformed people who say, well, how long is a generation? And then they take various places in the Bible, and usually it winds up being somewhere around 70 years. Say, well, by the time Israel becomes a nation, you're only going to have, there's got to be sometime in the next generation, the next 70 years. And guess what year that is? 2018. So I grew up hearing that, you know, Israel became a nation by 2018. We should expect that Christ is right there, right at the door. Like I said, well-intentioned, but I think very misinformed, because what's the generation that's not going to pass away? The generation that sees what? These things. The abomination of desolation, the prophets with great power to destroy and mislead many. The ones that see these unmistakable signs in the heavens and on the earth. That generation is not going to pass away, because it is then. It is right then. We do not need to try to set the time. Because Israel became a nation in 1948, Israel could cease to be a nation tomorrow. I don't think for a moment that that would impact God's plan to reconstitute them as a people. I do believe that there was some significance when they retained status as a nation. I do believe we are drawing near the end, but it does not shake my faith or impact my eschatology one bit if Israel ceases to exist tomorrow. God could reconstitute them as a nation 100, 200, 1,000 years from now. I don't think he will, but that's, again, none of that impacts how we understand the text. What impacts my understanding of the text is how these things have come to pass so far and how that informs my assumption, my biblically informed opinion of how they will happen again in the future. So the generation that sees these things is not going to pass away, but the specific hour itself is unknown. That's what Jesus says in 36. But of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven or the Son, but the Father alone. For the coming of man will be like the days of Noah. For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark, and they did not understand until the flood came and took them all away, so will the coming of the Son of Man be. In other words, people, the world, is not going to understand, although they see the signs of judgment. Did everybody see the boat Noah was building? Yeah, it's hard to hide an ark in your garage, guys. They saw, they heard the message, they saw the signs, they heard the warnings, but they were blinded to it. We should expect the same thing, that although we preach the message of the kingdom, although the birth pangs have started, even up to and including these drastic signs, although people will see the signs of judgment, they simply will not care. By the way, you read through the rest of the prophetic literature in the New Testament into the Revelation, that's exactly what happens. Even when people start to see the explicit signs of God's coming judgment, they do not care. Their hearts are hardened. And the moment that they get it is the moment that they're taken away in judgment. Look at verse 40. Then there will be two men in the field. One will be taken and one will be left. Two women will be grinding at the mill. One will be taken and one will be left. How many of you have heard that used as a rapture verse before? Yeah, that's not a rapture verse, guys. Guess what happens to the one taken away? What's the immediate context? They're taken away in what? Judgment. This is at the coming of Christ. And he is not coming to take those away and bring them into the kingdom. He is gathering them and bringing his kingdom to earth. But in the various contexts there, they did not understand, verse 39, until the flood came and took them all away. Who did the flood take away? Did the flood take away Noah and his family and salvation? No, they got to stay on the boat. The flood took away the ones that were under God's judgment. The next verse does not suddenly change to the ones taken away being under God's protection. Again, lots of well-meaning people. I grew up with it, this being the rapture verse. There's songs written, you know, a Left Behind song. It's like, it uses that verse. I think it's out of context. I don't think you have verse 39 taken with verse 40 and 41 the same way. Verse 39, the ones that are taken away in judgment. 40 and 41, the ones that are taken away in judgment. Although they saw the signs, although they were preached the message, their hearts were hardened, and they do not understand the full weight of what is happening until they are taken away in judgment. Which is why, starting in verse 42, he starts out with these parables about being ready for his coming. Be on the alert. You don't know when it's coming. Know that the head of the house, if he had known what time, if the thief knew when the head of the house was coming, he would have been on the alert. He would have wouldn't allowed his house to be broken into. Who's faithful? The one that the slave, verse 45, who then is the faithful and sensible slave whom his master put in charge of his household to give him their food at the proper time? Blessed is the slave whom his master finds so doing when he comes. In other words, there's this idea that you need to be ready when Christ comes. It's perfectly consistent with the parables that we saw in Matthew 13, by the way, that the kingdom is not in full force right now. The wicked continue to carry on, but we need to be ready when it happens. Chapter 25, we're really behind. We've got to move forward. Chapter 25, the parable of the 10 virgins. Nope. One version, one parable. Parable of the 10 virgins. 5 who were ready and 5 who were not ready. 5 who were prudent and wise and 5 who were foolish. The ones who enter into the presence of the bridegroom are the ones who were ready for his coming. What distinguishes those who are of God and those who are not are those who are ready and anticipating his kingdom and his coming. Starting in 25:14, he gives the parable of the talents. Those who know that the master is coming are to use wisely what he has entrusted to him. Those that do not use the resources wisely understand or show that they really don't understand the master at all. That's the one where he gave some talents and this one made more, and he gave this one some talents and he made more, and he gave this slave some talents and he buried him, you know, because he didn't want to lose it. But really what he showed is that he didn't understand the character of the master at all. He wasn't truly under relationship to the master. Those who are ready, those who live in anticipation of the coming of the master, anticipate not only moving into his presence, but they anticipate reward at his coming, which, by the way, is also a consistently biblical idea. And I want you to look to Matthew chapter 25, verse 31. Matthew 25, verse 31 is a very interesting and important verse. But when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, then he will sit on his glorious throne. This is a critical verse when it comes to the timing of when Christ sits on the throne. Because the question is, where is Jesus? And we all know that he is at the right hand of the Father, right? Hebrews makes that absolutely clear. Psalm 110, prophetically we know where Jesus is. He is not floating around here and there. He is not making special command appearances to his particular prophets and apostles today. He is at the right hand of the Father where he ever lives to make intercession for us. Yes, we can agree on that. But what's Jesus doing? Is he sitting and reigning on David's throne now? Because that is a very, very popular understanding. That Christ, in some sense, is ruling now. That he is exercising his kingdom authority now. Now here's the distinction. Is God on the throne in control? Yes. Psalm says, your throne, O God, is forever and ever. There is never a question that God is not on the throne in control, sovereignly over the entire created order. However, the Davidic throne is distinct from the heavenly throne of God. The Davidic covenant, the Davidic throne, had a particular beginning point, did it not? Where was that? When did the Davidic covenant come in force? 2 Samuel chapter 7? Come on, guys. 2 Samuel chapter 7. We're going to keep going over these things. You got to know some addresses. 2 Samuel chapter 7, God says, I will do this for you. I will build you a house. I will give you a name. I will have one of your descendants on the throne forever and ever. In other words, the Davidic covenant, the period that might not have an end point to that throne, but it did have a beginning because there was no Davidic throne before David. So when does Jesus sit on his throne? Well, look at what it says in verse 31. When the Son of Man comes in his glory. And when all the angels come with him. Has that happened? Has Christ come in his glory and all the angels with him? Well, he comes in my heart and he is glorious. Maybe. But you do not have all the angels in your heart. The world has not been changed in appearance and structure by the coming of Jesus into your heart. The world's systems were not shattered and overthrown by the coming of Christ in the hearts of his people. This whole context has been pointing to a specific coming of Christ that is unmistakable, yes? And he answers right here when that happens, when the Son of Man comes, when the angels come with him, then he will sit on his glorious throne. Not he will have been sitting, not he will continue sitting. When this happens, then this happens. It is a sequential thing. He will come, and then he will sit and rule and reign. Jesus is not sitting on the Davidic throne now by his own words. It is a very, very critical timing piece in all of this. And how do we know? Because look at verse 32. And all the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate them from one another as the shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. Have all the nations been gathered before Christ? Have all the nations been refined and separated? Has the world gone through a universal judgment of faithful versus unfaithful? No. How do we live now? We live in the reality of the parables in Matthew 13, that for right now, the wheat grows up amongst the tares, or the tares grow up amongst the wheat, don't we? That when you drag net, when you drag this world, and when you see it all put together, that there's good fish and bad fish, that there's worthless, and that there's value in there. The judgment, the refining, the sifting has not happened yet. But it's at that time that the king will say to those on his right, come, you who are blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. That kingdom is not an afterthought. That kingdom is not something that has some implication for when the world decides that it's ready, when it comes, when the world is prepared for it. No, it's prepared from the foundation of the world. This kingdom was planned, purposed, designed from the beginning. We have to end there because we are out of time. We're going to conclude the Gospels with that. Again, there are many, many things that we could look at different ways, and I'm fine with that. Those specific points of the passage, whether he is specifically addressing Jews as he looks to a universal picture, we can debate on that. But what I think is clear and needs to remain clear is that where Jesus looked at prophecy, it was fulfilled literally, not only as he predicts things like the destruction of the temple, but even as he applied it to himself with the same prophecies in Isaiah. And now as he uses those again, it makes the most sense to see that they will happen again in the same way, with a literal understanding, the plainest understanding of the text, that as he looks forward to the future and we ask, is Jesus on the throne now? It is not the same as asking whether God is in control or not now, because we absolutely affirm that he is. But is the specific Davidic covenant promise being fulfilled in the rule and reign of Christ right now? I think Jesus very plainly says that it's not. That he will sit on that throne when? At a very particular time, when he comes in power. I think it lines up perfectly with what it says prophetically and looking forward into Hebrews. He said, my Lord said to my Lord, today you are my son. And he says to the son, sit here at my right hand. How long? Until I make your enemies a footstool. Sit here until the time for judgment comes. And then, no longer are you here, then you are sitting on the Davidic throne. I think there is a distinction that happens there. And I think Jesus points all of those things toward the future, something that we still see as future. All right, a fine job. We'll get back after it.